Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine brings you public policy lectures, debates, and panel discussions from across Maine. Speaking in Maine today takes us to Portland and the World Affairs Council of Maine for a panel discussion on what's next for foreign policy under the Trump administration. The panelists today are Charles Norchie, Professor of Law and University Trustee Professor at the University of Maine School of Law, Richard Barron Parker, Professor Emeritus at Hiroshima Shudo University, and Laura Henry, Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. This program was edited for length. The full program is available on our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast.
Welcome. I'm Amy Holland, Executive Director of the World Affairs Council of Maine. As most of you know, the World Affairs Council of Maine is a nonpartisan, educational nonprofit dedicated to connecting Maine and the world. Thank you for joining us tonight, and thank you to Veryl Dana for generously hosting and sponsoring this program on U.S. foreign policy. Our first speaker, who will also serve as moderator, is Charles H. Norchie, Professor of Law and University Trustee Professor at the University of Maine School of Law, and a member of the Board of Directors of the World Affairs Council of Maine. He directs the Center for Oceans and Coastal Law and the Graduate Law Programs, and teaches international law, oceans law and policy, international human rights, and maritime law. Please join me in welcoming Charles Norchie, who will start us off.
Thank you, Amy, and again, thanks to all of you for coming here tonight. Well, I would like to introduce our panel, and it's good that we are here this evening to consider international law and foreign policy under the incoming administration. Our speakers, after yours truly, shall be Richard Barron Parker. Richard is Professor Emeritus of Law at Hiroshima Shudo University, Hiroshima, Japan. He first went to Japan as a Fulbright lecturer at Tohoku University, followed by 2 years as Visiting Professor of Law at Osaka University, followed by 18 years at Hiroshima Shudo University, where he spent a lot of time explaining the mysteries of American politics, political theory, and foreign policy to the Japanese, just as he will to us this evening. He holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Chicago and a JD from Harvard Law School. Afterwards, Professor Laura Henry. Laura is a John F. and Dorothy H. McGee Professor of Government at Bowdoin College, right here in Brunswick, Maine. Her research investigates Russia's post-Soviet transformation and state-society relations from the former Soviet Union, in addition to broader themes such as environmental politics and global governance. Among her books are Red to Green, Environmental Activism in Post-Soviet Russia, Russian Civil Society, A Critical Assessment, and her work has appeared in Post-Soviet Affairs, Europe-Asia Studies, and other journals. She has been a Watson Foundation Fellow and a Fulbright Scholar and has received support from the National Security Education Foundation, the Social Science Research Council, and so on. Then we will hear from Professor Jim Richter. Jim is Professor of Politics at Bates College, again here in Maine. Professor Richter teaches courses on international politics, the politics of Russia and Eastern Europe, and ethnicity and conflict. For much of his career, his principal research interest has been Russia, Russia's domestic and foreign policies. And more recently, he has extended his research into the countries of Eastern Europe. So we certainly have a fine panel of experts this evening. I would like to start, take a few minutes to talk about international law concerns in the incoming administration. I should say that I do not take a political position one way or the other. In fact, I'm a registered independent, so I'll try to be as objective and scholarly as I can. Let me highlight a few areas. First, the United Nations. The UN, of course, is a membership organization founded by the victorious allies of World War II at a conference in San Francisco, which is still in the United States, and has more often than not advanced the American national interest and the common interests of the world community. It is called the United Nations because the United Nations were victorious in World War II. It is not a simple talk shop, an apparition on First Avenue in Manhattan. Yet there is talk of cutting U.S. funding, which is vital to the organization. The incoming administration is somewhat piqued over a recent Security Council resolution that criticized Israel over the construction of settlements in Palestinian areas. The resolution passed because a member of the United Nations, the United States government, declined to exercise a veto. 5 of the 15 members of the Security Council possess a veto under the Charter of the United Nations. We have seen this movie before. I see enough white hair in the room to know that you would recall Senator Jesse Helms, who was particularly unfriendly to the United Nations and pressed for the funding. At the time, I was retained as a legal advisor to a United Nations agency to work on this problem. And I can tell you that some very important agencies and programs of the UN were affected. These were programs that mostly served vulnerable populations and contributed to world order, and hence, in my view, were in the American interest. I could cite the UN Commission, High Commission for Refugees, the Commission on Human Rights, UNDP, which is the development program, UNICEF, UNIFEM, UNIDO, which is the United Nations Industrial Organization, the World Food Program, and even the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, or DPKO. So defunding of an important global organization can have serious consequences. Let me turn to another area of international law, the use of force, the law on the use of force. Let us not forget that when the United States was attacked on September 11, 2001, I happen to have been a resident of New York at the time and at the World Trade Center that very morning, the UN came to our aid. A Security Council resolution unanimously condemned the terrorist attacks, quote-unquote, which took place in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, expressed determination to prevent all acts that constitute a threat to international peace and security, and reaffirmed the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense, which are terms of art under international law that come straight from the Charter of the UN. The organization then acted under what is called Chapter 7 of the Charter, which has to do with war, and decided that all states shall prevent and suppress the financing of terrorist attacks and cooperate to prevent and suppress terrorist attacks and take action. The global organization took action on behalf of the United States. Shortly thereafter, Afghanistan, a country I know well, where I've worked on and off over many years, in support of the American interests, the Security Council, shortly after 9/11, authorized the establishment of an International Security Assistance Force, ISAF. The organization was set up to help stabilize the country and to contribute to order in that part of the world. Over the last decade, I took numerous advisory missions to Afghanistan, working with ISAF and other UN agencies, and I can tell you that their work was essential to Operation Enduring Freedom, which is the United States military action based on international law in that part of the world. Currently, the United States and Afghanistan have a bilateral security agreement, another creature of international law, known as the BSA. This is a framework for continuing U.S. support and basing of our assets in that country. It is unclear what will be the future of that particular agreement. Also related to use of force is NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a treaty organization. The incoming president has uttered disparaging remarks about NATO. Again, I think back to September 11, 2001. NATO immediately came to the assistance of the United States and for the very first time ever deployed assets out of Europe to Afghanistan. And let us not forget the annexation of Crimea by Russia is a flagrant breach of international law, particularly Article 2.4 of the United Nations Charter, which we can discuss later. And that makes NATO more vital than at any point since the end of the Cold War. China. Well, one Republican president opened China and brought the PRC, the People's Republic, into the UN. Now, will another Republican president undo this? The president who brought China to the United Nations was President Nixon. A president did terminate the U.S. Republic of China, Taiwan Defense Treaty, And that termination was deemed lawful by an important United States Supreme Court case called Goldwater versus Carter. Could that treaty be reinstated? Also, as a maritime lawyer, I think a lot about the South China Sea. Will we see a reset button? The People's Republic of China does continue to militarily reinforce South China Sea islands in violation of a very important recent international arbitration case called the South China Sea Arbitration. What will happen to that? Then there is what I like to call nuclear borders, unsettling places. There are border disputes, frozen conflict, and outright conflicts where international law matters very much. We can think of Kashmir, which is a border of India, Pakistan, China. We can think of what is called the McMahon Line. That is the unsettled China-India border, which has seen one war. The Durand Line, the contested border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the DMZ, which is the Korean Peninsula. Every one is a tinderbox that will require the attention of our new president. Now, what about the Iran agreement? The Iran nuclear deal, which is officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, was concluded July 14, 2015. It was the United States, the UK, Germany, France, Russia, China, the EU, and so on. Now, what will happen to this? Mr. Trump's statements on Iran and the JCPOA have been contradictory, ranging from promising that U.S. business access to the Iranian market will continue, which means the agreement has to stay in place, to suggestions that we will tear up the deal as the worst deal ever negotiated, and where ending it would be his number one priority. Now, I will tell you, as somebody who also does some international corporate law in that part of the world, that that deal is essential to American business interests in the Middle East. Now, the JCPOA is a political commitment under the Department of State. It is not a legally binding agreement. So, Mr. Trump could, as president, unilaterally, immediately withdraw Washington's commitments under the deal, and in my view, this would be dangerous and it would be detrimental to American business interests. Now, here's another heading. We'll call it Environment, Climate, Oceans. Mr. Trump has stated that he will cancel the Paris Agreement, stop payments to the UN Climate Fund. Anybody ever hear of NASA and NOAA? They're government agencies. They are part of our government. You might have seen the report in the New York Times, at least, that this week, the last month, and the year are the hottest on record. So what about the Paris Agreement, the conclusion of which was heralded as a landmark moment in the fight against climate change, 2015. The agreement was adopted under the auspices of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was a 1992 treaty ratified by the United States Senate with advice and consent of the Senate. The Paris Agreement is not such a treaty. It is an agreement. It does define how countries will implement its commitments under the UNFCC, the framework agreement. Because this was concluded as a sole executive agreement, which is a special animal, a very special kind of executive agreement, the president will have the legal power to terminate on his first day in office without any congressional authorization. However, the Paris Agreement does have enough signatories to take effect. It entered into force November 4, 2016. Under its terms, it does preclude countries from withdrawing within the first 3 years of its entry into force. So, Mr. Trump, the new president, could circumvent the moratorium on withdrawal, but there would be some constitutional obstacles. While we're under this topic, environment, climate, oceans, the Law of the Sea Treaty. Anybody ever hear of that? It's the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, whose negotiations were begun and championed by a Republican administration. It has not been ratified. Ratification of the convention for the Law of the Sea, or consent to ratification, is actually what happens in the Senate. The Senate does not ratify. It gives its consent to ratify. To achieve that would require a threshold of 67 votes. That is unlikely. However, there is strong support for ratification on the part of the United States Navy, mining interests, hydrocarbon exploration interests, and let us not forget that Nixon went to China. So we shall see. International trade law. As a matter of international law, NAFTA, we know about NAFTA, explicitly allows the United States to withdraw from the agreement, provided that it is given 6 months' advance and written notice of withdrawal to the other parties. Under U.S. law, however, it is unclear whether Mr. Trump could withdraw from NAFTA without the support of Congress. NAFTA is a congressional executive agreement and was implemented by Congress through the NAFTA Implementation Act, which is silent on termination. On to the topic of trade, a biggie, the World Trade Organization, situated in Geneva, Switzerland, one of the major, the essential sinews of the international trade system. Mr. Trump has also suggested that he would withdraw from the World Trade Organization, or the WTO. Now, the WTO comprises a number of separate multilateral agreements, which are extremely important, and I think that any attempt to withdraw would include a constitutional, would necessitate a constitutional challenge. Withdrawal from NAFTA or the WTO, as well as other trade or investment agreements, would significantly affect American companies' abilities to access foreign markets, would impact customs, duties, tariffs, and recognition of regulatory standards all over the world. So treaty renunciation or withdrawal, this is a topic. I won't go into it in too much detail. It's a little bit inside baseball. But whether the United States can withdraw from, denounce, or terminate an international treaty is not merely a domestic issue. It is also a question governed by international law, which requires either compliance with a specific withdrawal procedure set out in the treaty or satisfaction of a limited number of exceptions. Now, under U.S. law, international agreements fall into three basic categories: treaties, congressional executive agreements, and sole executive agreements. Of the three, the latter is the easiest to unravel. So, to conclude, under the United States Constitution, Mr. Trump will be vested as president with broad powers to act in the sphere of foreign affairs. But that executive power is not absolute. He will not be able to act unilaterally on all matters affecting treaties or international arrangements, particularly with ratified treaties that have received the Senate's advice and consent to ratify, and where the Congress has passed implementing legislation. This is not easy. International law, after all, is a communications process. It's based on global expectations about certain content, certain authority, certain expectations. So you might ask yourself, when it comes to an authoritative expectation that may have legal consequence, what is a tweet? What is a tweet? The real law of the community, of the international community, are going to be those processes of decision that are consistent with community members' expectation about what is right and about what is effective. International law is important because it introduces a measure of predictability in what is otherwise a potentially anarchical international system. So with that, I would like to turn this podium over to Professor Parker.
Okay, first I'd like to say that I'm a Democrat who never voted for a Republican for president in my life, and nothing I say is objective. It's all from a, it's all from a point of view. Charles is right, though, that I am going to sort of talk to you like I was talking to the Japanese, in the sense that I want to take a much more aerial view, and I want to actually try to predict what Trump is going to do. Charles has laid out a lot of the problems he's going to face and decisions he's going to have to make. But what is he going to do? What is he going to do? I see a lot of my Ollie students here. and they are familiar with a lot of what I'm going to say. Just before 9/11, I was teaching in Japan. I've been in Japan pretty much continuously from 1983 to 2008. And just before 9/11, an extraordinary book was published, Special Providence by Walter Russell Mead. And he's a historian, and he outlines four schools of American foreign policy, which I think, in fact, can help illuminate where Trump is and what he's likely to do. The four schools he called Hamiltonian, Wilsonian, Jeffersonian, and Jacksonian. I think it's fair to say that since the Second World War, the Hamiltonian and Wilsonian schools have been dominant. The Jeffersonian, well, let's start with Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian is Bretton Woods. It's the IMF. It's NAFTA. It's GATT. It's the WTO. It's the worldwide system of banking that we have. It's major international corporations where, even though they're nominally Japanese or American or British, in fact, they're really international. And to be fair, this Hamiltonian push has probably lifted well more than a billion people out of really dire poverty. Now, Wilsonians are the UN and all its councils. They're all of the arrangements that Charles referred to. They include NATO. They include our entire alliance system. And I think both of these schools really held sway from the Second World War until President Obama. And one reason they held sway is that you had the Jeffersonians really of major importance in the 1930s. Jeffersonians are people that don't want to get involved. They're non-interventionists. And they really, they think that the idea is to perfect our own American society, and our influence on the world should be by our example. Now, of course, during the 1930s, we essentially did that. We didn't intervene. Hitler could have been stopped in 36. He could have been stopped in 38. And so Jeffersonianism really got a bad press. And after the Second World War, we plunged in, and the Wilsonians and Hamiltonians were really dominant. What happened, though, is, and in part we were forced into that by the bipolar structure of the Cold War. We sort of had to get out of our traditional distance from the rest of the world, and we really got involved and became a world hegemon. Then the Cold War ended, and we won. And so about 1989 or 90, I think both the Hamiltonians and the Wilsonians kind of went over the top. The Hamiltonians' capital at this point really started moving around the world. And you had the displacement of probably tens of millions of people out of their occupations. You had this extraordinary concentration of wealth, which they're talking about in Davos, I think, as a serious problem. You had this extraordinary concentration of wealth. And the Wilsonians, I think, also went over the top. On the right, say, you had the neocons. And we had the idea, we're not just going to make the world safe for democracy, we're going to give it to them with military force, and we'll knock off these dictators, and democracy will flourish all over the Middle East. And then on the left, I think you had interventionism, humanitarian interventionism, responsibility to protect. If a country is really maltreating its citizens, we have an obligation to march into that country and correct the problem. Now, what happened, I think, is that all of this was kind of an overreach, and I think Obama was elected in part as a Jeffersonian to correct it. I think Americans generally felt they were, and feel now, that they were badly overextended, and we have to pull back. And Obama, I think, bragged today that there used to be 180,000 troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now there are only 15,000. And I think he's really done his level best to pull us out of the Middle East. Then we get to Trump. I think Trump is a Jacksonian. And I really urge you to read Walter Russell Mead and his analysis not only of Jacksonians in foreign policy, but domestically. I mean, he really describes in great detail a lot of Trump's constituents. They're centered in what Colin Woodard called Appalachia. It's the Scots-Irish. It's the core of our military. And what are Jacksonians like? And actually, I thought at first they were just maybe Trump's constituents, but maybe he isn't really a Jacksonian. But the more he talks, the more I think maybe he really is. I think this recent dissing of NATO was really deliberate, whereas I thought earlier it was just campaign talk. So what are Jacksonians like? They are, and I think they constitute at least a quarter of the population of the United States. They're not represented in universities. They're not represented on the coasts. They are realists, and they are pessimists. They really don't think the rest of the world is perfectible. They don't really think it's worth interfering in the rest of the world. They want to stay at home, ideally stay at home and not mess with other people. They believe very much in a very strong defense, but they really mean defense. It is very, very hard to get Jacksonians to go to war. So before the Second World War, where FDR was desperately trying to get us into war, there England's fighting for its life. The Soviet Union had already been invaded by Germany. Finally, we get into the war. Why? Because of Pearl Harbor. Only because of Pearl Harbor. The Germans probably made a major mistake declaring war on us. It's not clear we would even fought them if we could just have dealt with the Japanese. So Jacksonians really have to be provoked before they go to war. Once they go to war, it's Katie bar the door. Jacksonians have no problems with dropping atomic bombs on Japan. You remember during the Vietnam War, I was really struck by this at the time. During the Vietnam War, there was a minority of about 25% of the American people who consistently thought that we should use tactical nukes in Vietnam. And they said, look, we're sending American boys over there to die. The least we can do if we can win this war tomorrow is do it. And, you know, they would give 10, 12 tactical nuclear weapons, wipe out North Vietnam. And I think that the Jacksonians really don't believe in war on a dimmer switch. War is either all or nothing. And so the Wilsonians and the Hamiltonians, you know, little force here, little force there, it's diplomacy. Jacksonians generally don't believe in diplomacy. And I think we can now sort of look at a couple of areas of the world and see what's going to happen. I think in the Middle East, actually, although Trump is sort of talking in a tough manner, I think we do have a Jacksonian enemy in ISIL, that is, in the caliphate. But I think his Jacksonian response is to be, we crush the caliphate and we use anybody we can to help us, the Russians, you know, you name it. The enemy of our enemy is our friend. We crush them, and then we go home. I think that in this sense, I think, because they both belong to non-interventionist schools, I think both both Obama and Trump are on the same side of the interventionist-non-interventionist divide. So I think, in a sense, Trump may complete really the withdrawal from the Middle East. The key, I think, is, are you a Jacksonian enemy? Another thing, you might look at Russia, and that's one of the most interesting things, I think, about Trump, is his attitude to Russia. Russia is not now a Jacksonian enemy. They were for all of the Cold War, but they're not now. Look, they could blow us up tomorrow, but they don't. They're not, and we don't worry about that either. And so Trump says, well, look, they'll help with ISIL. And I think he realizes that it's not to our advantage if the Russian economy goes south. They'll just get more nationalistic. So he goes and he says, look, we'll help you. We'll help you, Russians. You know, your economy is going into the tank. As Obama says, they're a regional power. They don't make anything that anybody else wants. So he goes to him, and you know my Secretary of State. This guy is the perfect guy to stimulate your economy without a Marshall Plan. We're not going to send any federal money. And so that's really interesting. I think it's really interesting. One of the advantages of Jacksonianism is that unless you're an enemy, people are pretty easy. People are pretty easy. Trump's going to be easy about Crimea. I think Samantha Power was on the NewsHour. And she was saying, no, no, we can't. We have to establish as an international principle that you just don't walk across national boundaries. You just can't grab territory. But I think Trump is going to say, you know, it was always part of Russia. And all those people in the eastern Ukraine are they speak Russian. And so why not? Just, you know, okay, you can have Crimea. Well, I'm not going to make a big fuss on it because basically Jacksonians don't place much faith in all of the institutions that Charles has mentioned. They really don't. And you're talking about a big part of the American population. So I think a lot of this stuff may be undone. And so let me close now by just going to East Asia for a bit. I think East Asia, our policy out there has been remarkably stable ever since the Vietnam War and Nixon's trip to China, through a lot of administrations. And it's a much more stable area than the Middle East. You have basically five powers. You have China, Russia, South Korea, the U.S., and Japan. And the boundaries are pretty much set. Japan has, you know, they argue about all islands with the Russians and the Koreans and the Chinese, but that's not a cause for war. And our policy, I think, to date, has been kind of to avoid the Thucydides trap, that is, avoid the status quo power, us, inevitably fighting the rising power, China. And I think we have sort of decided to bring them, and this has been a policy that's 40 years old, essentially try to bring them into the world order. I think that may continue. Again, China doesn't seem to be, even though he sort of talks like he's getting ready for negotiations, China, I think, is not a Jacksonian enemy. What might happen, though, is that Trump will not care very much whether China has military control of the South China Sea. I mean, what you'd worry about is the shipping. And China feels very strongly about the South China Sea. They really think it's essentially part of their territory, and neither China nor the United States has signed the law of the sea. And so I think China's pretty much going to take that militarily in the sense that we're not going to be able to send an aircraft carrier down there like we did in 96 down through the Taiwan Straits. But so what? I mean, we're Jacksonians. You don't mess with us, we don't mess with you. And I think that the adaptation to, you might say, spheres of influence is going to come fairly naturally to him. I worry a little bit about his relationship to Japan. And here I sort of share nervousness. I think he probably doesn't realize the value of the Japanese alliance to the United States. I think except for Canada and Mexico, it is by far the most important alliance we have. Strategically, and I think Mad Dog Mattis will talk to him about this, strategically, it's incredibly valuable to us to have all these troops in Japan. We have now about 28,000 troops in Korea and about 50,000 troops in Japan. And it's been fairly stable. I've been there almost this whole time. At the end of the Cold War, actually, you could really feel the two countries starting to drift apart because the Japanese would say, well, now the Russians aren't a threat anymore. Why do we have to have these thousands of troops in our country? And then the North Koreans fired a missile in 94 over the top of Japan, and you could feel the whole country just jump to the right. And the alliance is in pretty good shape now, I think. They trust us. They trust us. If they didn't trust us, they could have nuclear atomic weapons on missiles in a year or so. They have all the technology. They're not like the Iranians. And I think you could imagine a really bad case for Jacksonian stuff where we'd move back to the mid-Pacific. We would simply say, look, let's get out. Let's get out. Let's just go back to Guam or to Hawaii. The problem with that is I think the South Koreans and the Japanese and the Australians would all get nuclear weapons. And I think he could be talked out of that. Presidents have been talked out of things. Carter wanted to pull troops out of South Korea, and the Joint Chiefs talked him out of it. Reagan came into office sort of pounding the table about Taiwan, and Alexander Haig actually took credit for talking him out of it. And so I think, just to sum up, I think that not much is going to change in Asia. I think in some ways Trump will make the acceptance of the rise of China more acceptable. You have to realize his constituents are largely unvoiced to this point. And this is really an interesting political phenomenon. When I first started talking or thinking about this thing, I was going to try to say what I would say to the Japanese about Trump, how to explain Trump. And that's really hard. I mean, that's really hard and would require an awful lot of work. But I've exhausted too much time, and so I'll stop. Thanks very much.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here and part of this distinguished panel. I feel like I'm learning a lot. I have a tendency to be a little loud, so if I get loud, just give me the sign. So I know we all have a lot of questions about Trump's foreign policy, and I'm going to offer a few thoughts about U.S.-Russia relations, but I'm interested to hear from my fellow panelists and from all of you and the Q&A session. So in 2012, Mitt Romney said that Russia was the United States' greatest geopolitical threat. And Barack Obama responded by saying, "Hey, Mitt, the 80s are calling. They want their foreign policy back. The Cold War has been over for 20 years. And Mitt Romney at that moment became an object of ridicule for raising Russia as the greatest geopolitical threat and not the Middle East, for example, not China. However, since that time, Russia has made a lot of major geopolitical moves. We know it annexed the Crimean Peninsula, which was part of Ukraine. It fostered a conflict in eastern Ukraine. It intervened in the Syrian conflict to support the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And now, in 2017, we find ourselves confronted daily with unsettling news about Russia here at home, whether it's hacking into the Democratic National Committee or possibly the Russians compiling a dossier of compromising material, kompromat, on Donald Trump. These issues are hard to adjudicate while we're in the midst of them, but what I want to do is hit the pause button on some of those questions and look at the deeper interests that drive U.S. and Russian foreign policy. What can we expect from U.S.-Russian relations under President Trump? And what are the likely motivations of the Russian government, led by Vladimir Putin, and those of the Trump administration? So let's start with things that we know. And oddly enough, the things that we know are actually more about Russia than they are about Donald Trump. So first of all, we know that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin exchanged compliments. Trump has praised Putin as a strong leader. And Putin has called Trump talented. And he also called him colorful, which was mistranslated in the American press as brilliant. But actually, the word in Russian isn't quite as complimentary as all that. It's a little bit more like colorful. But aside from these exchanges of compliments, what are the deeper factors that drive their foreign policy interests for the next 4 or 8 years? So let's think about Russia first. There are two schools of thought about what motivates Putin's foreign policy, which has become more assertive and more unpredictable since 2012. So first, some scholars argue that Russian foreign policy is driven by decades of humiliation following the end of the Cold War. These scholars focus on Russia's loss of superpower status, on NATO expansion eastward into Russia's former sphere of influence. They also think about U.S. support for civil society organizations and for opposition figures who are critical of the Kremlin, and U.S. support for the color revolutions in Serbia and Georgia, Ukraine, and even Kyrgyzstan. All of these things making Russia very sensitive to its loss of power, and now finally Russia taking its revenge, responding to this humiliation. There's a second school of thought, and I should warn you that these aren't entirely mutually exclusive, but the second school of thought places Russia's foreign policy motivations in Russian domestic politics. And it basically says, since 2012, Vladimir Putin has been unable to maintain the social contract that he established in his first term as president back in 1999 to 2004. That social contract basically said to Russians, listen, We're going to improve the economy after the great economic recession of the 1990s. We're going to guarantee increasing living standards from year to year. But in exchange, you need to stay out of politics, right? We need political quiescence, and we need really you to tolerate growing centralization of political power in what many Western scholars call the creation of a soft authoritarian regime. However, since 2012, due to plummeting oil prices, due to widespread corruption, due to the lack of modernization in the Russian economy, and now economic sanctions, Putin hasn't been able to uphold his part of the bargain. So what happens? Instead, we have glorious little wars that cause a surge of patriotism in Russia, that cause people to rally around the flag and bolster Putin's popularity in an otherwise very challenging time for him. So some people think that this is what has driven Russian foreign policy. Now, you can see that these two different analyses of Russian foreign policy lead us to different expectations. If the former is true, if Russia is responding to humiliations of the 1990s and the early 2000s, then it is certainly possible that a friendlier, more pro-Russian government in the U.S. could lead to improved relations and a new understanding, especially a new understanding of Russia's sphere of influence. So a U.S. administration that would reduce the pressure on Russia to become more democratic, to observe human rights, could alleviate the immediate tensions between the two regimes. However, if Russian foreign policy is driven, in part, by a domestic legitimacy crisis, then the U.S. has served as a very useful scapegoat for Putin. And anti-Americanism and anti-Westernism has been something that has become very important for the Russian regime. In that situation, we might see a period of relatively good relations as Putin sees how far Trump is willing to go in creating that new dynamic. But the underlying reasons for Putin's position against the West will endure. And Russia still might find the U.S. to be an important scapegoat. So we wouldn't expect that relationship to be very enduring. What do the Russians want as they look at this interesting opportunity of having Donald Trump in the White House? Well, first and foremost, of course, they want an end to economic sanctions that were put in place after the annexation of Crimea. And ending sanctions is one of the more likely policy outcomes of the Trump presidency, in part because there are a number of European allies who also would like to end sanctions. Italy, Spain, some of the East European countries would also like to end sanctions because they are eager to do business in Russia. With Rex Tillerson as the possible Secretary of State, this is something that we might see happen in the near future. But there are other things that we're not as certain about. So certainly Russia would also like to see the U.S. withdraw its influence from the domestic political systems of the former Soviet Union, including Ukraine. They would like to see a much more hands-off policy in Ukraine. They would like Crimea to be recognized as part of the Russian Federation. They would like a commitment that there will be no further eastward expansion of NATO. And it's even possible that the Russians will ask the U.S. to withdraw the very controversial Magnitsky Act, which limits the travel and financial transactions of some of Russia's elite. So and actually some optimistic pundits in Moscow have even proposed a transportation corridor across the Bering Strait to bring the U.S. and Russia together and as a sign of friendship. This seems highly unlikely to me. The challenge for all of these issues is that even if Trump is willing, and we don't know, I'm actually excited to hear that Trump is a Jacksonian because I've been puzzling over this kind of opportunistic deal-making that seems to characterize his orientation. So if he has an organizing principle, that is indeed comforting. But the challenge of it is that these things need to actually be accepted by the foreign policy community. These things actually need to pass through Congress for the most part. These things will be received by our allies with varying degrees of acceptance or protest. These are all huge challenges. It creates trade-offs for other things that Trump might want to do, right, in foreign policy spheres in Congress. And at this point, I want to come to a very peculiar dilemma that I see sort of emerging in U.S.-Russia relations. this very tricky contradiction. So Putin has, or sorry, Trump has praised Putin as a strong leader. And he really seems to admire Putin's single-minded pursuit of Russia's national interest. He similarly desires to be a strong leader. He is going to pursue the U.S. national interest as he sees it in a single-minded way. In addition, Putin has been unpredictable. He's willing to subvert the post-World War II global order. He's willing to violate the rules in unexpected ways. Trump also claims unpredictability to be one of his great strengths. The challenge is that U.S. and Russian national interests do not always align. What happens when these two strong leaders single-mindedly pursue national interests that are not in harmony with each other? What happens when unpredictability meets unpredictability, right? What will be the result of this happy relationship at that point? I think we don't know. We're not actually sure. And that brings me to a whole variety of things that we don't know. Past administrations, whether sincerely or perhaps less heartfelt, have portrayed U.S. foreign policy as being based on the promotion of democracy, on the promotion of human rights, freedom of association, the press, religion, as strongly principle-driven. But Donald Trump, we know, talks about making deals and perhaps heralding a new era of pragmatism. But at base, what do the Russians have to offer the U.S.? Now, there are some things Russia has to offer. Russia's a nuclear power. It has a significant military. And it's modernizing its military as we speak. It is strategically located, whether you're thinking about Asia or Europe or the Arctic. But really, in the end, Russia has an economy that is only the sixth or even the 12th biggest in the world, depending on how you count it. It has a declining population. It has a pretty small consumer market. It has high levels of corruption. And it has a political system that fundamentally doesn't jibe with our own. So what deals can we extract from Russia? I mean, that's a little bit of a puzzle. As we try to anticipate what these deals might be, and we look at Trump's selections for foreign policy and intelligence positions, we become even more confused. Mike Pence, Jim Mattis, Rex Tillerson, Michael Flynn, Mike Pompeo, they are not unified at all on the question of what U.S.-Russian relations should be. Mattis and Pompeo would seem to imply kind of a continuation of current positions. Flynn, more willing to rethink the status quo. Tillerson, trying to articulate some kind of realistic approach. In this context, prior to the inauguration, when Trump remains relatively unconstrained by the foreign policy community and is able to tweet to his heart's content in Trump Tower and isn't having those daily briefings, his first couple moves have actually really surprised me. So you might have read in the Times of London interview over the weekend that Trump suggested we could end economic sanctions against Russia in exchange for some kind of new nuclear deal. Well, this is surprising for a variety of reasons. One is because the sanctions were put in place based on the annexation of Crimea. So in a sense, it sets aside that issue entirely and shifts the whole conversation to nuclear issues, proliferation. But usually, nuclear issues are not a quid pro quo. They are negotiated separately, right, as something of their own. So this is an interesting move. I was surprised only because it's interesting that Trump puts Russia's most desired outcome on the table immediately, right, rather than waiting. So what would Trump ask for in return? It's not clear. He stated numerous times that Russia and the U.S. should work together to fight the Islamic State. That seems possible. Lavrov has invited Trump to talks on a peace agreement on Syria that's happening actually on Monday in Kazakhstan. Trump's not going, but it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that meeting. Russia would also like a new U.S. summit. But Trump has already given away many things that the Russians want. He's questioned the NATO alliance. He's questioned the European Union. And actually, there are some ways in which Trump's foreign policy runs up directly counter to Putin's. Putin has cultivated a close relationship with China as very important to the future success and resilience of the Russian regime. I think that Trump envisions possibly replacing China in the U.S. system with Russia, but I think that's very unattractive to the Russians themselves. Actually, I think it'll be interesting to see what comes of it. Right now, I would guess that Trump's actual policy toward Russia will depend to a certain degree on his advisors and whom he speaks to. And this is something that we do not yet know. How constrained will a President Trump be by the trade-offs inherent in foreign policy? Let me just take 1 minute to talk about hacking and the intelligence dossier, because I feel like we're in a room, and this, we're talking about Russia and the U.S., we can't not talk about it. But I want to talk about it just briefly, actually to pour a little cold water onto some of the overheated rhetoric about Russian hacking and about the dossier. While interference in our elections in the United States is certainly an extremely serious issue and should absolutely be investigated, ultimately, Trump won the election for reasons that had nothing to do with hacking, and Clinton lost the election, I think, for reasons that had nothing to do with hacking. And what I would do is caution us against the kind of wild speculation that makes the Russian regime sound more unified, more powerful, and more intentional than it actually is. Moscow has not been cultivating Trump as a Manchurian candidate for years now, even though it will be very happy to opportunistically take advantage of whatever Trump is willing to give them. I think we have a tendency to see the Russian regime as more coherent and unified than it actually is. And there's a lot of evidence that there's competition among intelligence agencies inside Russia. Now, some of this competition is to please Putin. But just knowing that the GRU intelligence service may have authorized the hacking against the Democratic National Committee doesn't mean that Putin himself personally ordered it. Everybody knows that Putin loathes Hillary Clinton, has for many years, especially since 2011 and the parliamentary elections and the protests that follow. But there is no evidence that there was any expectation inside Moscow that Trump would win the election before he did. In fact, many people were in shock, and some of the cooler heads in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs are a little bit worried about it, because Clinton offered a wonderful opponent against which to push back, and things are a little more ambiguous with Trump. Similarly, with the dossier, the Russians compulsively collect compromising material, and everybody. It's possible that this compromising material actually exists. I couldn't say. It's not been verified. I don't have any insight into that. But I think it can be a little bit distracting. There are lots of things we don't know about President Trump's conflicts of interest that would be useful and helpful for us to know if we want to understand his foreign policy. And those things are primarily financial and don't have to do with his personal life or his private life. And I think we need to keep our attention on that broader issue rather than becoming focused on the specifics of this dossier. So in conclusion, let's avoid hysteria on both sides. Trump is not Putin's puppet or a foreign agent. Neither is Putin able to mastermind global conspiracies as a kingmaker in the Kremlin. That kind of thinking is overblown and unhelpful. We have to remember, Russia is just another state. It is not a chess player, you know, thinking many moves down the board, nor is it a drunk stumbling down the road, right, as Mark Galeotti said recently. So what I really think we need to remember is that Russia has been brilliant at playing a relatively weak hand. And in many ways, Russia grows stronger as Western alliances weaken and Western democracies weaken. So it really is our own domestic politics that create opportunities for Russians to sow mischief, to encourage cynicism and apathy, and to demonstrate the hypocrisy in politics. Putin didn't create Brexit. He didn't create the migrant crisis. He didn't create the candidacy of Marine Le Pen. And he didn't create Trump. right? But he's ready, willing, and able to take advantage of all of those global changes. So sowing division among and within democratic states and then publicizing these divisions is a good way to make Russian politics look pretty normal and look pretty good in comparison. And I would say a U.S. president that actually facilitates that by questioning the value of things like the NATO alliance opens up greater opportunities for this kind of unproductive division. So we know that Russia will continue to pursue its national interest with methods more diverse than the past. So we could talk about hybrid warfare, disinformatia, if you want, in the Q&A. We know that Russia will try to exploit divisions in NATO and the EU and among U.S. political elites. But anybody who tells you they know what Trump is going to do is bluffing. But we can expect initially that Trump will pursue a warming of relations with Russia. We just don't know how long that warming will endure. Thank you.
We're going to have to stop here. I'd like to thank Professor Richter and all our panelists tonight for such a wonderful conversation about the future of foreign policy. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's session was in Portland for the World Affairs Council of Maine and a panel discussion on what's next for foreign policy under the Trump administration. If you missed all or part of today's Speaking in Maine, the program is available on our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. I'm Jonathan Woodward.